UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG Talks. My name is Pradeep Mundre, and I'm your host for today. Now, the number of colonoscopies in the gastroenterology practice has significantly increased over the last few years. Along with the increased number of procedures and with the improvement in image technology, the focus on quality, improvement in bowel preparation, there has been a huge increase in the polyps that are being diagnosed. And majority of these polyps tend to be small, possibly insignificant polyps. And they add a huge burden, huge implications on cost, utilization of our precious histopathology resources, and possibly environmental impact. One may even start to argue that probably in certain circumstances, these small polyps could just well be incidental. Whether we want to call it that way as incidental lesions or not, probably depends on various factors, and probably one of the most important being malignant progression or risk of malignancy in these things. Now, today, our discussion is focused on this very important topic on diminutive polyps, their risk, and the burden they pose. Today's guest is Dr. James East. James is a consultant gastroenterologist at Oxford John Radcliffe Hospital and is also a consultant gastroenterologist at Mayo Clinic in London, UK. He's also an associate professor of the Translational Gastroenterology Unit at Oxford University and has academic interest in GI cancer prevention. And James, you must all know, is published widely and has been author of several national and international guidelines on this topic. Welcome to the UEG Talks, James.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here and for the invite from UEG. And I think diminutive polyps, this is a great time to be talking about this as an issue.
Thanks, James. Can we start with the official terminology for these polyps? I've realized that lots of our trainees and lots of other people are not very familiar. How do you define diminutive polyps, small polyps? Is there a standard internationally accepted terminology with these things?
I think this has changed a little bit over time, but I think we've kind of come to consensus in the last decade. So the cutoff between a small and a large polyp, I think, has been consistent for some time. So small polyps are less than 10 millimeters in size, and large polyps are 10 millimeters or beyond, and by definition, advanced lesions. Whereas diminutive polyps are now, I think, fairly consistently defined as being less than or equal to 5 millimeters in size, and therefore small polyps fit in the middle, being 6 to 9 millimeters in size. Some of the old literature talked about small polyps as sort of 5 to 9 millimeters, or occasionally small would go up to 10. But I think we've now come down that diminutive polyps are now 5 millimeters or less in size.
Excellent, James. So that clarifies things for a lot of our colleagues and a lot of our listeners. Now, would you be able to give an estimation of the burden of the diminutive polyps? We're particularly dealing with those in this talk, maybe from a European or an international perspective, probably in terms of numbers and sort of the financial burden they pose.
So diminutive polyps are important. They're 80% of the polyps that we detect. And in fact, 90% of the polyps that we detect will be either small or diminutive. So they're the vast majority of the polyps we find. However, only 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 maybe of diminutive lesions are going to develop into a colorectal cancer. And so most of these are non-progressor lesions. The problem is we don't know which of the 1 in 10 are going to progress. And so currently we would resect them all. However, you know, this high rate of resection leads to a significant workload for our pathologists, and certainly they are in short supply in the UK. And so as we're increasingly detecting diminutive lesions, that's coming with substantial costs. And it's estimated that if we stopped sending low-risk diminutive polyps to pathology, at least USA costings, the savings would be as much as $1 billion annually. And that, you know, there's an environmental cost with this as well. If we just think about, you know, the CO2 generated by pathology processing and reporting diminutive polyps, again, you know, thinking about numbers from the US, that this is roughly equivalent to how much CO2 we would generate by driving an average car for 2 million miles a year. So, you know, there's significant financial cost, there is significant environmental cost. However, diminutive polyps are an important key performance indicator. we know that the adenoma detection rate correlates strongly and inversely with the post-colonoscopy colorectal cancer rate. So for each 1% absolute increase in adenoma detection rate, we see a 3% relative decrease in the post-colonoscopy colorectal cancer rate. So probably our detection of these diminutive polyps is probably a reflection of how meticulous and the quality of the mucosal inspection that we do.
So you're trying to say the diminutive polyps themselves may not pose a risk, but in high adenoma detectors, because they are looking carefully, they're probably detecting other lesions which may turn into cancer. Is that trying to say, or these lesions actually turn into cancers?
I think that the vast majority of them are acting as quality indicators, and very, very few of them will be those lesions that progress onto becoming advanced adenomas and then onto a cancer. So as you said, most of them are probably not clinically relevant.
Jim, certainly there's a big burden with these things. And how do you think has this evolved with time? Lately, over the last many years, there's been significant focus on improving quality of colonoscopy. And with that, the polyp detection, and there's been huge improvements made in bowel preparation. Image technologies kind of come leaps and bounds. And there's a huge array of endoscopic accessories that aid mucosal exposure are being used in daily practice. And I guess with the introduction of artificial intelligence, we are detecting polyps which we did not see within the exposed areas as well. All the studies on any of these technologies seems to predominantly increase detection of diminutive adenomas. How do you see this burden in the future for our already outstretched health services?
I think that's a great point. I agree. You know, polyp detection rates have steadily increased over time. And, you know, if we look now in the literature, we're seeing studies reporting adenoma detection rates consistently more than 50%. Whereas if you look back, you know, historically, maybe a decade or more, you know, adenoma detection rates of less than 25% were quite common. So the burden of adenoma detection is going up, and that's obviously driving more surveillance. However, there is a paradox here that those patients who've had the best examination and get the highest number of adenomas detected get the most surveillance. But these are probably the patients who are at the lowest future risk, whereas those who have a less good examination and fewer adenomas detected get less surveillance despite being at higher risk of having a missed lesion. So there's a bit of a sort of tension there. In terms of the sort of technology that we've had over the last few years, certainly, you know, high definition, I think, has helped. Advanced imaging techniques are helping us detect more adenomas in the field of view. And then other developments, you know, wider angle scopes, wider field of view. And I agree, some of the mucosal exposure devices, thinking about caps and cuffs, are helping us see better behind folds in a more controlled way. And this combination of better detection in the field of view and exposing more of the mucosal surface has really driven up polyp detection rates. And then, you know, the sort of most recent bit is AI, which has been exciting, if not revolutionary, in helping us detect more polyps in the field of view. However, and I think you've been gently alluding to this, it's not clear what the value of detecting these additional diminutive adenomas is, as they don't necessarily represent a more meticulous or comprehensive mucosal inspection, and they may not really reflect higher quality or necessarily correlate with lower post-colonoscopy colorectal cancer rates. It's possible that, you know, AI might even lead to a form of a sort of gaming of our key performance indicators. And so it may be that when we're reporting key performance indicators in the future, we need to express whether AI was used or not. So there might be a sort of AI adenoma detection rate or a, you know, without AI adenoma detection rate, so that we know that whether people are getting that additional benefit when trying to judge whether they're meeting key quality metrics.
That's a great point of the paradox, James. Now, moving on, thanks for highlighting sort of the huge burden of these polyps. And I guess earlier on, you alluded to the risk of these polyps. And I want to move on to the risks of the diminutive polyps. And I guess the way I deal, I mainly deal with large sort of polyps. And the questions I always ask myself is, what is the risk of harboring cancer within the polyps? Or let's say if they are benign, what is the risk of malignant progression? And how long do they take? How long that process might take? And then I move on to the patient factors, the complications, and the, how well the patients can tolerate complications. a complication in a 40-year-old is very different from a complication in an 80-year-old with comorbidities. Of course, the risk approach to risk in diminutive polyps is very different. Can you give your viewpoint on the risks of such small polyps in the longer term, the shorter term, on those angles?
No, I think risk for diminutive polyps, our thinking has changed a bit on this recently. Historically, we might have quoted, you know, the time to go from being a tiny adenoma or a tiny serrated lesion to being a cancer. You know, historically, we might have quoted 5 to 10 years. But I think with more recent data, you know, I think we've pushed that out a bit. We're probably looking at 10 to 15 years now, and maybe for serrated lesions, even a bit longer than that. Therefore, that risk of developing cancer over time is lower, and we need to weigh that up versus the risks of resection and the benefits to the patient of removal in their lifetime. So many of these polyps will not be relevant in the lifetime of older patients. So thinking about the risk of resection, I mean, I think that's changed as well. So historically, you know, when I was training, we would have used hot biopsy or hot snare to resect even diminutive lesions. But nowadays, almost all of these lesions would be resected with cold snaring, which is both more comprehensive and substantially lower risk. The risk of delayed bleeding, you know, or having a perforation after cold snaring is really exceptionally low. It's a very safe technique. And so in terms of, you know, the sort of cancer risk, you know, when you see a diminutive polyp, again, the risk of there being cancer in situ in that lesion is almost negligible. If you look at big Japanese series, where they're very meticulous about observing and collecting those lesions, the risk of submucosal invasion in a non-depressed diminutive polyp is of the order of maybe, you know, 1 in 6,000, maybe 1 in 10,000. And when those tiny lesions, you know, when the patients with those tiny lesions that did have cancer in, and so these are in massive series, they operated on a few of those patients, maybe half a dozen, none of them had involved lymph nodes. So these are tiny polyps, an almost negligible portion will have cancer in them. And if you then go back and operate on these patients, there's no additional value in doing that. So I think the risks in terms of cancer risk right now are tiny.
I guess the main point to highlight, James, is how long it takes for these polyps to turn malignant. Not only turn malignant, I think we should also think about, once they turn malignant, are they going to contribute to mortality or morbidity of the patients? Because we get extremely sort of worried about, at least some of us do get extremely worried about these small polyps in older patients. So maybe we can relax on that based on sort of what you've said. James, it's clear from the above discussions that diminutive polyps are a massive burden, and this will only get worse. And probably the current routine practice is we remove all this, we send them for histopathology analyses. Maybe in the longer term, it's probably no longer sustainable. So time for us to make some changes. And what are your thoughts on where we are in terms of this? What can we do to change the way we're doing, and where are we at overall?
Yeah, Pradeep, I agree. I think it is time for us to kind of rethink the whole polyp pathology paradigm, because I think there is a risk that, you know, with very high rates of detection, diminutive polyps risk overwhelming us. And so we need to consider potentially new approaches that don't include pathology, because I think, you know, for diminutive polyps, pathology actually offers relatively limited value for these very low risk lesions. You know, one strategy that's been proposed, and we're probably beyond a decade into this, is this idea of resect and discard. This would involve endoscopists making an optical diagnosis of the polyp, removing the polyp, and then not sending the tissue to the pathologist. So we would take responsibility for the pathological diagnosis. A further alternative to that is, it's perhaps a little bit more controversial in the West, but certainly is used in Japan, is diagnose and leave. Given that we know perhaps, you know, only 1 in 10 or fewer of these lesions will become a cancer, we could potentially make an optical diagnosis and leave the lesion in situ as long as we were confident the patient would return for a surveillance examination. But that's maybe easier in Japan than the UK, where they're more confident their patients will come back for a small adenoma. However, this might be appropriate, probably is appropriate, because we were allowed to do it in Bowscope in the UK, that for diminutive hyperplastic polyps in the rectum, we know that diminutive hyperplastic polyps essentially have no risk of developing into a colorectal cancer, nor do they predict future colorectal cancer risk. If we could confidently diagnose those lesions, we could leave those behind, and so-called diagnose and leave.
James, just to touch upon the issue of diagnose and leave, we diagnose that there's a hyperplastic polyp in the rectum with a high confidence, then we can leave. If we diagnose it as an adenomatous lesion, so we resect and I guess discard, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is certainly in the UK, this would mean that all lesions proximal to the rectus sigmoid would be resected, and we would be mainly focusing optical diagnosis on the rectum and or rectus sigmoid.
I know it's being introduced in the UK bowel cancer screening program. Is there particular standards that we need to meet for optical diagnosis? Is there some internationally accepted standards for this, or any training that is necessary before such things are implemented? Certainly in the symptomatic patients, we have not adapted it, and the bowel cancer screening program certainly in the UK will be introducing this. So are there any standards that we need to meet at all, and are they internationally accepted?
So in terms of thinking about sort of training and implementation, this would require significant practice change to implement at scale. So we would need endoscopists to be trained in optical diagnosis, and AI may be helpful to support us here. They then need to make a high confidence prediction that they're sure what pathology is, and they will need to be able to store a high quality image of the polyp in the long term, because this will replace the sort of pathology slide that we would otherwise have. And there is a need to be both accredited for this, so to show that you can meet the appropriate performance criteria, and over time to be re-accredited. And in fact, this little sequence of requirements is in fact what NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Healthcare Excellence, which is the UK body that says what we're allowed to do in clinical practice, that's what they recommended when they gave opinion on whether resect and discard was acceptable in clinical practice. They required all of those things. But making that change across the entire endoscopic community requires potentially requires substantial resources. In terms of the sort of required accuracy, we had the PIVI criteria from the US and subsequently SODA from the ESGE in Europe. The SODA criteria is slightly more accommodating in terms of the diagnostic performance that's required compared to matching to pathology. And for SODA, they require for leave in situ 90% sensitivity and 80% specificity compared to pathology. And for resect and discard, slightly lower, because we're not leaving lesions behind, at 80% sensitivity and 80% specificity. But I think the key thing here is we need good correlation with surveillance guidelines and a high negative predictive value if we're going to be leaving lesions behind.
So it looks like the auditing and sort of practice certainly seems achievable in a sort of well-designed program or well-funded program like bowel cancer screening. But in the symptomatic patients or in the other pathways, it doesn't look that easy. Are you aware if any other societies or any other countries are adopting the resect and discard strategy at all, other than the UK bowel cancer screening program?
You know, there's a lot of enthusiasm for resect and discard. And, you know, Doug Rex, who's very well known in the US, from saying, you know, not that we can do resect and discard, but we should do resect and discard. And certainly UK NICE criteria say we can do it, that there's support both in Europe and the US. But nevertheless, this has not led to widespread implementation, even though the cost savings are potentially quite significant. And you know, if we look at reasons why people have not really embraced this, first, I think, you know, endoscopists still worry about medico-legal risk, that tiny risk that there might be a cancer within it, or, you know, almost unmeasurable risk. But if the patient comes back with a cancer that might have been nothing to do with the tiny polyp that you did resect and discard on, you still might be liable. So I think people are concerned about that. The second is it requires some effort to do this at the moment. You have to go and get trained, get experience with advanced imaging. We have to adopt systems and pathways to accommodate this. And so while it would almost certainly save the healthcare system money, it's not necessarily of any benefit to endoscopists and their businesses personally. And so unless there's a change in remuneration where people are going to get paid for, you know, for taking on this extra effort and risk, it may be hard to implement and get changed. And I think there may also, particularly outside the UK, where perhaps pathology pressures are less, there may be considerable resistance from pathologists as well who potentially would lose income. When we're thinking about this, you know, in terms of trying to get it done, you know, sometimes looking at these things, it's helpful to look at them kind of backwards to fully understand them. This is a concept from Charlie Munger, who was Warren Buffett's sort of right-hand man at Berkshire Hathaway. So if you're, you know, trying to convince a healthcare leader that we should change this, I mean, maybe, you know, the UK, we'd be talking, you know, Amanda Pritchard is the CEO of the NHS, or You know, maybe you're talking to the head of Kaiser Permanente, and you'd say, "So Amanda, we've been doing this system of optical diagnosis and resect and discard of diminished polyps. It's been very effective for a long time. It's very safe. Patients get their surveillance interval on the day, but we've discovered this problem. There is a tiny risk that there might be a little cancer in one of these lesions. And so we're going to propose a change. We're going to stop doing optical diagnosis, and instead we're going to send all of the diminutive polyps to pathology because, you know, there's, you know, 1 in 6,000, 1 in 10,000 chance that there might be a cancer." And so, you know, Amanda would say, "Well, that sounds very interesting. And does anyone die of those cancers?" And I said, "Well, actually, we're not sure. You know, when we operate on them, we never find any lymph nodes. But it is, you know, it might be a risk. So how much is that going to cost the NHS?" Said, "Well, you know, projections from when we've looked at this and we've modeled US data, it's going to cost $1 billion annually." You know, the idea that we're going to send all polyps off for a risk of cancer and death that is almost immeasurable for $1 billion a year, you would be laughed out of the room. But that's what we do. And, you know, we've known that we can do optical diagnosis for more than a decade now. And so, you know, that's $10 billion. You know, it starts to add up to real money. So I think, you know, there are cost savings. And I think when you look at it backwards, actually, it's insane that we don't do this already. But to get this done, it doesn't work unless we do it at scale. You know, the whole community needs to buy into this, the whole GI community. And that means, you know, often people who are in private practice, because actually across Europe, that's where most of the colonoscopy is being done. If we're going to get them to engage, we probably need some sort of remuneration to drive that change. I think in the UK, for bowel cancer screening, I think it's really exciting that they've decided to adopt resect and discard. Pilot sites are planning to start training in the next month or two. But I think the bowel cancer screening program in the UK is uniquely set up to kind of start this. Endoscopists have had additional and advanced training. Particularly, we have really excellent data capture within the program. And I think, you know, there are these clear cost savings, which for the NHS, the cost pressures are very significant. And our pathologists are overwhelmed. They don't need any more work. They could do with a lot less work. So the sort of pushes and pulls to help us implement in the UK, I think, are different. But I think, you know, it's very exciting that the UK is leading on this, because I'm not aware anywhere else worldwide, despite the fact we're allowed to do this, where people are routinely delivering optical diagnosis and resect and discard at scale. So, you know, potentially another first for the UK bowel cancer screening program.
James, can I briefly touch upon anticoagulants and antiplatelet agents when removing diminutive polyps? What's your understanding? What's your take on this? Really talking about diminutive polyps here. Would you remove when they're on DOACs, oral anticoagulants or warfarin, or dual antiplatelet agents?
So again, I think my approach to this has changed a bit over time. And certainly, I think, you know, the risk of removal of diminutive polyps on clopidogrel, the elevation is very minimal. And so nowadays, I think I would be willing to do that without stopping the clopidogrel. And similarly, you know, for warfarin, there's some nice Japanese data looking at either stopping your warfarin, starting heparin, and then coming back onto warfarin, or just continuing the warfarin and resecting with polyps. And again, probably the risk of bleeding is pretty even between those two, or the risks of developing a sort of thromboembolic event and trying to make that change on and off warfarin. So again, for a patient on warfarin who is within their standard range, I would be willing to resect a diminutive polyp, probably with cold techniques. And again, you resect the polyp, you can then, you know, flush the defect, wait a minute or two. If there's ongoing bleeding, clipping is now so straightforward and routine that we can easily clip up those sites. I think for DOACs, I've had a number of bad experiences, which I think many of us have. They are potent, fast-acting anticoagulants. I think I would think very carefully before resecting even diminutive polyp on a DOAC. You know, that needs to be balanced against the risk of bringing the patient back for a further colonoscopy. You know, there's a risk of PrEP, there's a risk with sedation, and equally, you need to weigh up what the risk of the polyp is, you know, overall in that patient's lifetime. So if you've got an elderly patient on a DOAC with a diminutive polyp, you know, that's probably never going to trouble them in their lifetime. So actually, is it sensible to take the risk of a bleed? Probably not. Is it sensible to take the risk of a repeat colonoscopy? Probably not. That might be one to sort of diagnose and leave in situ and just accept that polyp's never going to trouble the patient in their lifetime.
Thanks, James. Of the final point, I just want to summarize what we've discussed in the last sort of half an hour or so, and maybe with a case scenario. So I think that's what we deal with on a day-to-day basis. And this is very common. I just want to kind of, let's say, a hypothetical case, a 75-year-old male, diabetic, hypertension, chronic kidney disease, probably a sort of congestive heart failure with a metal mitral valve on warfarin. But he's very fit, very independent, let's say, a performance status of one, undergoes a sigmoidoscopy, a 5-millimeter polyp was found in the descending colon, was not removed because the patient was on warfarin, and a CTC was done to, let's say, did not show any proximal lesions. And let's say this lands on your desk for a decision making. Okay, what do you do with this polyp? Can you walk us through quickly sort of what thought process that you're going through with this kind of situation and how would you sort of deal with it? It's not, there's no right or wrong answer with these things, I think, but I just wanted to know your opinion, how you deal with such a situation.
With all of these things, ideally one would discuss it with the patient and, you know, you sit down with them and say, these are the risks and these are the benefits. On the risk side, cold snaring and clipping on warfarin, you know, the risk of having a significant bleed is small. It's not zero, but it's pretty small. I think the risk of a perforation would be almost negligible. If you were coming back for a sigmoidoscopy, you'd have to have an enema. But again, the risk of having a sigmoidoscopy is smaller than having a colonoscopy. You know, that's the sort of procedural risk side. And then, you know, you need to say, well, so in exchange for this, you know, what benefit would you get? You know, what's the chance of this being a cancer now? Essentially, almost zero, unless it's a depressed lesion. What's the risk of it turning into a cancer in the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years? Very small, but not absolutely zero. What is your chance of being alive in 10 years' time? And with that selection of comorbidities, I think the chance that that patient survives another 10 years is very small. So although the risks are very small, the benefits, you know, are almost zero as well. And so, you know, if that was me or my relative, I think, you know, I would be putting through and say, actually, this is probably not worth it. This is not going to extend the length and quality of your life. But equally, if the patient said, I can't cope with the idea that there might be a precancerous polyp inside me, I've just got to have it out because I'm never going to be able to go to sleep. You can say, well, you know, we're going to take it out. We probably won't do you any harm, probably. But equally, it's not really going to benefit for you. But if it helps you sleep at night, that's fine. And so a sigmoidoscopy, cold snare, and maybe a clip would be reasonably expensive. But if the patient required that for reassurance, you could probably just about justify that. But as I said, I think for me, I would try and leave that alone.
Yeah. In practice, most patients say, oh, I'll do whatever you say, doc. I just did a little exercise on this particular scenario, and I normally use Charlson's comorbidity index. And the 10-year survival for this particular patient was 0%. So you can argue your point that way. James, do you have any, just coming towards the end of the discussion, do you have any final important points to make that we've not covered? Any take-home messages for our listeners at all?
I think, you know, resecting discard, as we've been discussing, it's this huge opportunity for saving cost in gastroenterology. You know, this should be the poster child for new AI technology to allow the implementation of optical diagnosis and resecting discard across the GI community at scale. But I think if we're going to achieve that, we probably are going to need some sort of remuneration to get widespread adoption across Europe and the US. But the prize is huge. You know, $1 billion cost saving per year and 2 million miles less CO2. Even Warren Buffett might consider that a reasonable amount of money to make this worth shooting for.
James, thanks for that excellent summary. And thanks for sharing your thoughts on a sort of clinical scenario, which we sort of routinely come across. We sort of summarize that these diminutive polyps are a huge burden and the risk they pose is minimal. That's probably the take-home message here. Thanks so much for joining us with the chat today.
Great. Thanks very much. And thanks to UEG for inviting me.
Thank you.